Today, instead of going slowly through or in details through a given topic, I'll try to cover three topics. It's more of just giving you an idea of, with three examples of things that you can learn more about or that are actual applications, current applications of tensor networks. And the first part is going to be about tensor networks in more than one special dimension. So far we've looked at matrix product states and meta for one-dimensional systems. And now I want to tell you a couple of things about higher dimensions. First one is we'll look at how to get the area law in two or larger dimensions, and then how to get the logarithmic correction to the area law also in two or higher dimensions. So remember what we've seen in one dimension. We have correlations in the matrix product state were exponential because they were exponentially suppressed in the distance within the tensor network geometry. The geometry was one dimensional. In the meta, we had power law decay of correlations, which was again exponentially suppressed in the shortest geodesic paths within the tensor network. And so the idea is that how you put together the tensors, how you build your tensor network affects the structural properties of the wave functions that are represented. And not only in terms of correlations, but also in terms of entanglement. This time what we want to know is how hard it is to cut a piece of the wave function from the rest. And we saw that in the matrix product state that consisted in just cutting two bond indices, whereas in the meta for the same type of interval, you had to cut a number of indices that depended on the size of the interval. Okay, so it's all about how you put together the tensors, what type of geometry, discrete geometry this tensor network is representing. And so now what we want to do is to try to do something similar in higher dimensions. And the first thing we can do in higher dimensions is to take the simple idea of a matrix product state, a one-dimensional array, and just build instead a two-dimensional array of tensors. So if you wanted to describe a wave function on a two-dimensional lattice, the first thing you could think of is just attach a tensor to each site on the two-dimensional lattice and connect the tensors, nearest neighbor tensors, through some bond index. Okay, and so that's known as the projected entangled pair state. And it turns out that it may or may not be intuitive, but the type of correlations that we can have in this case, the decay of correlations could be either exponential or power law. Okay? We can build, in this case, both power law and exponential correlations, but the entropy is going to scale according to this area law. And we can do something similar with meta. But if we use it with meta, what we'll see is a power law decay of correlations in two dimensions, and again, an area law, so no logarithmic correction. So let me explain these projected entangled pair states a bit more in detail. First thing we ask always is this an efficient representation? And the answer in this case is straightforward, because what we have here is that the number of tensors is proportional to the number of sites, so the cost grows linearly in the number of sites. Now, can we efficiently manipulate this tensor network? For instance, we may want to compute the scalar product. So in this case, to compute the scalar product, we'll take the ket, the bra, and then contract all the indices, all the physical indices pairwise. And the net result, if you look at it from the top, is a two-dimensional tensor network. And you already saw during a tutorial, you try to contract this efficiently, and the answer was no. There is no way, right? The cost was exponential in the linear size of the system. So if we try to compute the scalar product of a PEPS, okay, of this two-dimensional tensor network, there is no efficient way of doing that. The cost is exponential in the shortest distance, the shortest linear size. Okay? So this could be the end of it. But it turns out that the same way that we saw that we could, in some situations, simulate a time evolution in one dimension by taking the evolution operator, replacing it with a Trotter expansion, and then taking an MPS that we would contract and simplify and so on, you can also, similar to the time evolution with matrix product states, here what we can do is we can look at the top row and say, look, this is a matrix product state. This top row is a matrix product state, right? And then this second row of tensors, you could think of this as implementing some time evolution. And so you can multiply the top row with the second row. That will give you a new matrix product state with larger bond dimension. This is the top row. Now we can contract it with the second row. And this will give you a new matrix product state. This looks like this part here looked like a matrix product state, right? And this looks like a matrix product state as well. So all I've done is I've contracted tensors pairwise, right? These two together, and so on. Okay? And the idea is that you have a matrix product state, but the bond index, the bond dimension has been squared. So if this was capital D and this was capital D, now this is capital D squared. And so that's not good, but if for some reason, it's possible to now truncate this index, this bond index, back to dimension D, then we would be back in the initial situation, and we could continue to contract in this direction. Now, why should this be possible? Well, it turns out that when you use a PEPS to represent the ground state of a local Hamiltonian, such simplifications are possible. Okay, they're approximate, so it's not an exact contraction anymore, but still, the physics of the ground state, the structure of correlations in the ground state, seem to imply systematically, for all the cases that we try, that we can simplify this contraction, that we can contract vertically, and then obtain a boundary MPS that we can then simplify by truncating the bond index. Okay, so there is an approximate contraction scheme that, of course, it's approximate, so we don't get the scalar product as that we wanted, but some approximation to it only, but then it's efficient. Okay? And this, in practice, is seen to work quite well, and actually this projected time and pair state, even though the scheme is only approximate, is one of the most powerful techniques we have to simulate two-dimensional ground state. So then let's talk about structural properties. What happens if we want to study a two-point correlator? Well, it's the old story. We have to put two insertions between the ket and the bra. So these are the two insertions. And when we look at it from the top, after multiplying the whole thing, what we have is a tensor network, which is, again, square with the two insertions. Okay? And now now I'm not worried about how do we extract this number out of it, that there will be some approximate scheme to do that efficiently. What I want to ask is, what type of correlations do we expect as a function of the separation between the two insertions? Do we get exponential decay of correlations? Do we get power law decay of correlations? And it turns out that generically, so if you choose for a random choice of the content of the tensor, I'm going to assume that all the tensors are the same. So it's a homogeneous PEPS. Generically, what happens is that the correlations are again exponential. And if you want to understand why, this exponential decay is because all the correlations, generically, the correlations are mediated between these two points, are mediated by mostly by the shortest path between the two tensors. And so in some sense, you are again just applying some transfer metrics a number of times. Okay? That would be a way of arguing that every time, if you separate the red insertion a little bit more, you'll have to in order to compute this expectation value, you'll have to multiply once more by some transfer metric. However, it turns out that we are not restricted to this type of correlations. These correlations, as I said, would be what you get if the correlations are mediated mostly by the shortest path between the two insertions. But imagine a situation where the same two insertions now are such, or the tensors are such that the correlations are not just mediated mostly by the tensors in between, but there are contributions to the correlator you know, these tensors, these Born indices, are codifying correlations, are allowing the different sides to be correlated. And imagine that you have a main contribution just directly from one to the other, but there are also contributions to the correlator from all the other tensors. In that case, one can see that actually one gets power law decay of correlation. Okay? This is not, I'm just giving you the intuition of what's happening here. This is not very rigorous, but what's rigorous is that you can actually build PEPs with one dimension two, so the simplest possible smallest tensors, and still have power law decay of correlation. Okay, so the conclusion is that the picture is not as simple as in one dimension. There are many more things that can happen in two dimensions. Now, when it comes to entanglement entropy, I hope this is clear, that the entanglement entropy of the region of linear size L, so L times L region, if you look at how many bonds you have to cut, the number of bonds is proportional to L, so we automatically have this area law, okay, for the PEPs. Very good. So we have these PEPs with, as I mentioned briefly, we could have in two dimensions, just with this simple structure, which follows the geometry of the original lattice, we could have both power law decay of correlations or exponential decay of correlation, and we have an area law. Now, we could ask, what happens if we generalize the meta to two dimensions, and that would be a two, we would have a tensor network in two dimensions plus an extra dimension corresponding to scale, so I would have, I should draw here something in three dimensions, which I don't know anyone who dares to do that. It's fairly complicated. The only reasonable way to draw that is by slicing it and put a collection of two-dimensional plots. But anyway, the main idea is the same. Here instead of putting two sides together and then disentangling and then cross-graining, we would have the same happening but in a plane. So you would have disentanglers acting on neighboring sets of square sets of sides, and then you put four sides into one, and so on. Right? So you can imagine the idea. And when you do that, what you see is that we automatically recover power law decay of correlations, right? Because we have the same type of geometry, hyperbolic geometry. So given two points at some distance on the two-dimensional lattice, the shortest path through the network again goes into scale, and it's logarithmic in the distance between the two points. And the entropy, then the entropy is this, comes from computing contributions from different length scales, but we don't get the logarithm correct. Okay? We had this calculation at some point. There was this toy model that we had in two dimensions where what we saw is that we had contributions from different length scales, but the contributions were not uniform. As a matter of fact, as you change scale, every time you divide the length scale by two, the contribution from that length scale is divided by two, and we have this sum that that you remember well. So what we had is that there was a contribution of the order L from the lowest level, and then a contribution of 4L divided by 2 from the next level, 4L divided by 4, etc. And when we put these contributions together, we get a 1 plus 1 half plus 1 fourth, etc. And this thing here is always at most 2. Therefore, the whole thing goes as L, right? So that's the justification why in meta, in larger, in dimensions 2 and larger, we still get just the boundary law, this area law. OK? So the question we can ask is, how do we go beyond that? There are ground states, as we mentioned last week, that don't display area law, but logarithmic correction to the area law in two and three dimensions. So how do we go beyond the area law? And we know the answer now, and this is work from that it's only 2 or 3 years old. So what we need to do is generalize this meta into a more general structure called branching meta, where it turns out that we will not give up the important properties, namely we will have an efficient parametrization, efficient way of manipulating things. Okay? But we will be able to go all the way to volume law of entanglement. So we thought for quite a while that the key of tensor networks was that we were just exploiting this area law of entanglement. But later on, we saw ways of still benefiting from all the nice properties of tensor networks, namely an efficient simulation, and yet going all the way to a volume law. This only happens for very special states. They have a volume law of entanglement. They are not restricted to an area law. And yet we can still efficiently simulate them. So that goes under the name of branching mirror, because what's going to happen here is, if mirror, you can understand it. I hope you can recognize here the mirror, right? You have top tensor, layers, double layers of tensors, and so on, where I've just explicitly brought the, you know, this tensor here. This tensor here has one upgoing leg and two downgoing legs, right? And there is this extra leg, which is in a state zero. It's fixed to a state zero. So this is the quantum circuit version of mirror. And what we can do is we can actually use all these legs that are at state zero, we can actually make them more complicated. So you can think of mirror as a single branch of a more general structure where we could take the rest of legs and also put more gates on them in a very carefully designed way, such that efficiency, we can still have efficient computation. OK, so why should we care about? Well, first, there are lots of ways of doing that. So again, this is the mirror. We can think of the mirror as a single branch of this more general structure. This is the fully branched mirror, in the sense that we have as many branches as possible. So by branches, what I mean is that you can schematically represent all these tensor networks just by a branching a tree, where down here we have that all the sides are, there are these entanglers and isometries. There are gates involving all the sides, so single, there is no factorization. It's a single many-body system. But at this point here, you see that that we can split all the wires into two subsets, the left ones and the right ones. There are no connections between them. Okay? So I call these two branches. Okay? And this keeps happening as you go up and up, that there are more and more branches. So for instance, here you have four branches, one, two, three, and four, right? Four subsets of wires that don't talk to each other. And so that would be at this level, four branches, one, two, three, and four. And so on. And the top we have eight. So we can go from just a single branch, where all the gates from all the other branches are just set to the identity, all the way to fully branched mirror, and you can have things in between. Okay? And it turns out that depending on how many branches you have, how many active or non-trivial branches you have, depending on that, you'll have a different scaling of entanglement entropy. And this is expressed here. So we can go from, in one dimension, from a single branch, which we argue had logarithmic scaling of entanglement entropy, all the way to volume law for the fully branched structure. Okay. So this would be logarithmic scaling, a straight line in, if we plot length in logarithmic scale. Right, that's the entropy of a region as a function of the size of the region. This is 10 sites, 100 sites, and so on. So it's logarithmic, right? That's the usual mirror that we discussed previously. And then there are other scalings that are possible, such as log square or proportional to L, directly proportional to L. Okay? So the idea here is we managed to go beyond this, what we thought was essential to have an efficient simulation, which was low entanglement. It turns out that in some cases, you can go to full entanglement in the sense of volume law and still have an efficient simulation. So why do I say that you have more entanglement in these cases? Well, suppose, let's take just the case, the simplest case of having two branches. The idea is that in this case, if I try to break my wave function into two pieces, one for a region and one for the rest of the system, it turns out that I need to, the way I have to do that is by cutting one indices as before, but there will be bond indices that I need to cut on both branches. Okay? So both branches contribute to the entanglement end. And now, in the general case, if you had many more branches, you would have many more contributions. So we have increased the connectivity in some sense in the tensor network. Yes?
Yeah, so before we argued why Mera corresponds to what we think of as a ground state of a local Hamiltonian with two reasonings, right? The area law and the decay of correlation functions. Does the second argument still work for these fully branching Meras?
I don't understand this. I don't think we understand this fully branching Mera yet. So these are just rare wave functions. Definitely a generic wave function cannot be expressed in that way. But entanglement is not what decides, what makes it special, right? Because as far as entanglement is concerned, at least bipartite entanglement, this fully branched Mera cannot be distinguished from a random state.
It works for some reason, but you didn't find.
We don't even know what they represent. We don't know what they represent. For the fully branched Mera, we don't know what they represent. You know, this is work in progress, right? So what's important, though, is that, well, in one dimension, the simplest case gives you this. So the single branch Mera, the normal Mera, gives you this logarithmic correction as you expect for a ground states of gapless system. And as I said, we can go all the way to volume law, which we don't know what we want this for, but it's there. In larger dimensions, however, when you play the same trick in more than one dimension, what we find is, again, that you can go from strict area law for a single branch to the volume law, which, again, we don't know what it is good for. But in between, you can get this. So there is a pattern of branching, which is between single branch and fully branched Mera, where you get actually exactly the logarithmic correction. And so the question was whether this particular pattern that you can find, whether that would correspond to ground states or gapless systems in with a Fermi surface in two dimensions. And this is work for now 3 years ago, I think, 2 or 3 years ago. And actually, we managed to see that the ground state of free fermions on the square lattice with a Fermi surface actually could be well represented by this branching Mera. But this is, again, there is plenty of evidence that this is the case. But nobody has taken the next step and tried to use branching Mera as an answer systematically for ground states with a Fermi surface. Yes?
If you only have a logarithmic correction, it seems like instead of splitting every time, which is log L times, you only split log L times, no?
We can do the counting later. Okay. It's enough if you, instead of, if in four in two dimensions, if you take four sides into one, but you split the system into four contributions every time, then you would see that you get volume law. And if you take four sides into one and split the system into two, then you get the logarithmic correction. So some numbers of that. All right, so what we saw during the second week was this table using free fermions, where for one dimension, two dimensions, and three dimensions, we talked about the scaling of entanglement entropy in ground states, and we distinguished between gap Hamiltonians, for which we had an area law, and gapless Hamiltonians, for which we could have an area law or a logarithmic correction to it. Okay? And I said this exhausts all the known interesting cases of scaling of entanglement entropy in non-ground state, so area law versus a logarithmic correction. And what we've seen in this week, this third week, is that we were able to build matrix product state for gap systems in one dimension and Mera for gapless systems in one dimension, such that this scaling of entanglement entropy was matched by the tensor network. And then today, I've quickly mentioned that we have the same for PEPs and Mera for gapped and gapless systems in two and three, well, yeah, two and higher dimensions, And then we needed this branching meta, which we now have, to match the logarithmic scaling. So the conclusion is that given all the known scaling of entanglement entropies in ground state, we have, for each type of scaling of entanglement entropy, we have a corresponding tensor network that can match that. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean we can simulate all these systems. For one-dimensional systems, I think it's fair to say we have a high degree of control. We can efficiently simulate ground states in one dimension with matrix product states and meta. In two dimensions, things are not so simple. There have been significant progress over the last 5 years. We're using PEPS techniques for gap Hamiltonians. But when it comes to gapless systems, that's much more complicated. I would not call it high degree of success yet. Yes?
Yeah, so I was wondering, all of this is assuming translation invariance, right?
What is assuming translation?
Basically everything. Like
the scaling?
The scaling,
right. So,
but
so
once you add an impurity in your system, this doesn't work anymore.
The upper bounds stay there. You cannot have more entanglement than what the upper bound based on bonds that you have to cut. There is an upper bound that was based for the entanglement entropy that was not based on assuming translation invariance or anything. We just were counting how many bonds we have
to
cut.
Okay, but the thing is that in actually solving systems like in MPS, if in MPS in one dimension, if you have translation invariance, you only need to find one tensor, which you can do very fast, relatively speaking. But if there's no translation invariance, you have to find order n tensors, which is going to take a lot more time.
A lot more is linear. Many people are happy with linear when they hear it's not exponential. And that's the point, right? Yes,
well,
we all get greedy.
If you have to optimize order n parameters instead of a constant number of parameters, that might not be your algorithm in the end might not be linear anymore, depending on how you optimize and things like that.
Yes.
So my question is, like, once you have impurities, are there ways to deal with these things?
There are ways to deal with these things, and an impurity, if it's in a critical system, may still have scale invariants, and you can still adjust it. So there is plenty of work using meta to simulate efficiently impurities with a cost that is not proportional to the system size. But this goes well beyond the simple description I wanted to discuss today. I know I owe you because of this, but I'm not answering. OK. There is a lot that could be said about that. But it's I think, next layer of complexity. OK. So let's see. Second topic I wanted to briefly discuss. Tensor networks for statistical mechanics. I want to talk about things that we can do with tensor networks, not for quantum systems. We started talking about entanglement that requires a quantum system. But now it turns out that these techniques, the same type of techniques, the same type of ideas, can be applied also to classical statistical mechanics systems. Okay? So there is no ground state with entanglement, but it doesn't matter. We can still apply a similar idea. So in particular, what we've seen in recent times is how to do an RG flow in the statistical partition functions. And also, I want to briefly mention that, well, the reason why we can apply these techniques to a statistical mechanics system is that there is some connection between statistical mechanical systems and quantum systems. And using that connection, one can see that actually you can get a meta, which is the description for a ground state of a quantum system, attached to a statistical classical system. We'll see that in a second. So this is the connection I was talking about very qualitatively. I'm going to say that if you try to write the Euclidean path integral for a quantum system, that's a quantity that is very useful because you can extract information about the quantum system. But what I want to point out here is that your quantum system might be in one dimension, so there is a space direction to this object. And then the Euclidean path integral also comes with some Euclidean time direction. Okay? So you have space and Euclidean time. For a one-dimensional quantum system, this could be our spin chain. We'll have an object that spans two dimensions, space and Euclidean time. And that's also the case when we have a statistical partition function into a classical system in two dimensions. So to be very, very concrete, we could be dealing, on the left-hand side, we could be dealing with a 1D quantumizing model. So you would have a spin chain in one dimension, a quantum spin chain. And on the right-hand side, we could be dealing with a two-dimensional classicalizing model, right? So you put on the square lattice, you put your spins up, down, on the sides of a square lattice. Okay? And it turns out that these two objects, the statistical partition function, where you add over all classical configurations with Boltzmann weight, and the Euclidean path integral, which is related to the trace of this evolution operator in Euclidean time, these two objects actually are closely related. Okay? They can be written, both of them actually can be written as a tensor network in particular, where what we have here now is a two-dimensional tensor network, where each tensor you can think of as a way of encoding the Boltzmann weights of the classical partition function or information about the Hamiltonian in the quantum case. Okay? So that's very sketchy, but our starting point is that there is a very well understood way of writing either an Euclidean path integral or a statistical partition function for a quantum or a classical system as a tensor network. Okay? And as I said, where each tensor is related to the Boltzmann weights that we would have locally. Okay, so then we can encode these objects in a two-dimensional tensor network. And what we can do is we can play the following game. We forget about where these tensors are coming from. We just have a collection of a tensor network. And we can ask, can we define some form of RG transformation that simplifies this tensor network? Can we take blocks of, say, four tensors and use them to define an effective tensor, and then take blocks of these effective tensors and use them to define a more effective or tensor? Can we then obtain a sequence of coarse-grained tensors? Okay? And the answer is yes, and there have been many proposals over the years, and one that is very successful is from 2006 by Levy and Nave. It's known as Tensor Renormalization Group. And one thing that also happened in just a couple of years ago was that we understood how to perform this coarse graining of this tensor network using actually similar ideas from Mera. So this looks very complicated. So this is the initial tensor network for the partition function. This is the final tensor network for the partition function with coarse-grained tensors. So there is one tensor here for every four tensors up here. There are many steps that you would take, and it's not very important how you do that. The important thing is that there are elements that appear in these intermediate steps that are exactly one-to-one correspondence with the tensors in the Mera. There are these disentanglers that appear here. These green tensors happen to be disentanglers, and these orange tensors happen to be isometries, these building blocks of the Mera. Okay? And that was important in order to... So you could think of previous proposals, such as this one, as corresponding to this spin blocking that we discussed the other day, where there are no disentanglers. Okay? So in correlations at short distances may be preserved, not removed. We would expect an RG scheme to remove short distance correlation. And so it was important to think about a scheme where short distance correlations would be removed. And that can be accomplished precisely by introducing these entanglements and isometries into the scheme. And so what we can do now, the net result of doing that has been that we have an RG flow in the space of tensor networks, where, as I said, we just keep blocking things. But this produces a sequence of effective tensors, the original one, the one we have from one after one level of coarse graining, et cetera, okay, where the fixed point of this flow actually truly captures the universal information of, for instance, the phase transition if this was describing a critical partition function. Okay? So I'm saying there is a way of doing this coarse graining that matches the expectation, that produces an RG flow that has as fixed points the ones that you would expect to have. And for instance, to give you an example of what happens when we apply this to the Ising model, in the classical 2D Ising model, if we are below the critical temperature, then what you have here is where you're just going to plot. This is a flow in the space of tensors, right? We forget about Boltzmann wedge. We forget about where this is coming from. We just look at the tensors. And it turns out that if you scan the tensor itself, is these tensors have four legs. But as we said many times, if you put two legs together and two legs together, you have the matrix. And now you can take a snapshot of the matrix. You can look at how large the coefficients in the matrix are. And this is what this plot is showing you. Okay? So we have a sequence of tensors. We look at each tensor as a matrix. And as a matrix, we look at how many coefficients or the strength of the coefficients. Black means zero. White means very large coefficient. And so what you see here is a sequence of these coefficients for the matrices. This is the initial matrix. It has corresponding to some tensor. It has many coefficients that are non-zero. And as we cosgrain the partition function, we see that the resulting tensors are becoming simpler and simpler. And actually, after a number of iterations, we see a fixed point tensor. If we were to continue, we would see this tensor again and again. So what we find is that at the level of tensors, we can follow a flow that when the temperature is below the critical temperature, flows to a simple fixed point, okay, very simple fixed point. Yeah.
If I just contracted all the groups of four tensors into one, just like all at once without bothering with its entanglers, what would not be reproduced?
You would find, again, a fixed point after a while. But the fixed point would depend on the temperature that you've chosen. For each temperature, you would have a different fixed point tensor. And that's because you have not removed short distance details. So the final fixed point tensor remembers exactly what the original temperature was through these short distance correlations that you didn't remove. So what's important here is that if I start with 0.8 or 0.9 critical temperature, or any temperature below the critical point, I'll get exactly the same fixed point tensor. Now, if you do that at criticality, what you find is, look, the original tensors are very similar, and that's because the original the initial temperature was very similar as well. So the Boltzmann weights are a continuous function of the temperature, right? So you expect that very similar temperatures lead to very similar tensors initially. But as you flow according to the energy flow, what we see is that this tensor is not changing anymore. And this is its unique, its own fixed point. It's the critical fixed point. Whereas if we were above the critical temperature, again, the initial tensors, okay, are very similar because we are changing the temperature just a little bit. But the final tensors are very different. This one would flow to a different fixed point. Okay? This fixed point corresponds to the disorder phase. We're above the critical temperature, so the spins are not ordered. And that results in this very simple tensor, which happens to be related to this one. This one, the ordered phase, right, is the sum of spin up configurations and spin down configurations. Whereas this one it really depends on which base. Yeah. So this is a sum of spin up and spin down configurations. All the spins up, that corresponds to a point here. All the spins down correspond to the other point that you see. Whereas here, we only have all the spins pointing in the x direction in some random way. So this is the disorder. It's a classical system. So we only have all the spins are, you know, pointing nowhere in the z direction. But it turns out that the order fixed point is just can be understood from the perspective of just tensors as two copies of the disorder fixed point. Okay. So there is some structure of correlations that is reflected in these tensors. Yes.
Can you repeat what the actual blocking procedure was? If you have the four connected tensors, like how do you actually put them together to one?
Oh, how you do it?
In this process, yeah.
How exactly you do it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can refer to this drawing. So you have to do many, many things, right? Many as you see here.
Oh, okay.
But at each step, all you need to know is the tensor. You don't need to know the tensors far away. And it's a local manipulation. So this could be a very large system, a small system. It could be homogeneous, non-homogeneous. So tensors far away, the Boltzmann weights far away could be different from the ones here. But in order to cosgrain the tensor corresponding to the region, you don't need to know what's happening far away.
which, to some point here where you're throwing away information.
The information is being thrown away. For instance, when you put when here you had two connections, and then you introduce these isometries that bring them down to a single connection. See, there is one connection here. We had two connections that are replaced with a single connection. That means you are throwing away local degrees of freedom in some way.
Okay.
So you're simplifying. The net result is that you go from more tensors to less tensors. Yes?
This is different from having a 2D mirror and cutting, deleting like the bottom layer.
Yes, that, if you look at here, there are no physical indices. There are no open legs in this, right? So when we work, we're working with a two-dimensional classical system. There is no Hilbert space. There are no open legs labeling the states of, you know, each side or anything like that. So that is not like the 2D mirror. Okay, so we have the RG transformation for partition functions. Yeah.
If there's no open legs, then it's just you can in principle fully contract it, right?
In principle, yes.
So and it's just a number.
And then you'll get a number.
What number?
It's called Z partition function.
Ah, okay.
So if you wonder why a number is so important or what is how do you extract physics from this tensor network, we can forget for a second about tensor networks and go back to statistical mechanics. Right? You have a partition function, it's just a number. But what's important is that this number has some concrete dependence on sources, right? So this number could be a function of how you modify the properties of your system by introducing a small magnetic field, this and that. Right? So this has nothing to do with tensor network. You can have this discussion before tensor network. And in the end, tensor networks are just a way of getting the number. Yeah. All right. So what we said, though, before is that this was for so far for a statistical mechanics system, but we can also have the quantum system where the same type of object, this tensor network, represents the Euclidean path integral. And the Euclidean so the Euclidean path integral is interesting. If you cut it and put it, pieces of it into different geometries, you get quantum objects that are of interest. For instance, if I look at this type of Euclidean time, in the end, this is just the trace of an Euclidean time evolution. But if I don't take the trace, if I consider an Euclidean time evolution that is very long and stops somewhere, okay, stops somewhere. So this represents instead of this represents a torus where this side is connected to this one and this side is connected to that one. But if instead I consider putting the same type of object, same type of tensor network in the upper half plane, that will correspond to an Euclidean time evolution that is preparing the ground state. Okay, so here's an object that you can always build, which is the Euclidean time evolution for arbitrarily long times. And this is a projector onto the ground state. And what's interesting is that now we have a tensor network representation of it, and we'll see what we can do with that. Similarly, if instead of having this Euclidean path integral on the upper half plane, we put it on an infinite strip with infinite length strip with finite width beta, that will correspond, that will prepare a thermal state. And these two statements, again, have nothing to do with tensor networks. These are generic statements about, maybe you've seen this in quantum field theory, how you prepare a thermal state, how you can prepare a projector onto the ground state. Okay? But now I want to use this tensor network representation in this context to see what happens. So let's start with the ground state. The promise is that if I have this Euclidean path integral representation or this imaginary time evolution representation in terms of a tensor network that I drew here, then this tensor network already represents the ground state. Let me specify something that might not be clear from the drawing. So this represents a tensor network that is in the upper half plane, meaning it stops here. There are open indices now. And it goes on in the other directions. Okay? So imagine the upper half plane, and you just populate it with this tensor network. So because there is a real axis there in the upper half plane, where the same tensors suddenly are not connected to anyone, there will be this row of open indices. Okay? So I'm saying, let's take this tensor network, put it in the upper half plane. The result is many tensors, infinitely many tensors. They are all contracted with each other in according to this pattern. And there are these open legs at the bottom. And now what we can do is we can apply the same, exactly the same strategy of coarse graining that we would have applied if we didn't have this boundary. Okay? That's the strategy that I discussed briefly, or I mentioned briefly before. And the result then will be that blocks of four tensors here are replaced with single tensors, as before. But because we have an open boundary, at the boundary there will be there are cancellations. This is WW dagger. These two tensors are canceled. Okay? This is, this was U dagger, so these entanglers that are canceled with themselves. There are isometries that are canceled pairwise. But at the boundary, this U is not canceled with U dagger because there is no U dagger down here, right? That's what happens when you put a cat. That certain cancellations are not possible. And so we follow the same steps as before that produced a coarse grain tensor network. But now what we see is that at the boundary, there are cancellations that are not possible, and some tensors start to accumulate. Okay? And what's interesting then is that in a natural way, when you do that, you get a double layer of tensors at the boundary, right? Which correspond to these entanglers and isometries. And the coarse grain tensor network in the ball. And when you iterate that, so this was the step we just saw, when you iterate that, what's happening is that the bulk tensors keep coarse graining as they would in the absence of a boundary. But at the boundary, you keep accumulating layers and layers of these entanglers and isometries. And what's happening is we started with a representation, tensor network representation of the ground state, and we end up with a mirror for the same ground state. Okay? And this the difference between these two, so these two representations for the ground state are just representing the same wave function, the ground state. But from the perspective, from the computational perspective, they are very different. Because this is a two-dimensional tensor network. In general, we don't know how to efficiently contract those. Whereas here, we have a mirror for which we can now extract expectation values and do everything we want efficiently. Okay? So it was very nice to realize that you could take the Euclidean path representation of the ground state and convert it into a mirror. Because that means that now we can efficiently extract properties of the ground state. OK, so there was this connection. If we apply this technique, tensor network renormalization on the upper half plane, we get the ground state, a mirror for the ground state. And something similar happens here. So if we start with a thermal state, the thermal state, remember, corresponds to Euclidean time evolution for a finite amount beta. That's the tensor network representation. When we apply the same strategy, now we get accumulation of tensors at the two boundaries. There are two boundaries, one for the brown, one for the cat. Okay. And suddenly we have this object here which looked like a mirror, two copies of a mirror in some way. Well, the good news is we didn't know how to represent thermal state with mirror. We didn't know. There was no ansatz. The ansatz that we usually use is based on energy minimization, right? You have your proposal of how to produce, how you should be able to encode the ground state of the system. That would be this tensor network mirror. And now you do energy minimization. But what do you do for a thermal state? Right? Thermal state is not so clear what you should be doing. Well, it turns out that just by playing around with coarse graining Euclidean path integrals, you can end up with a mirror-like representation of a thermal state. And the point, again, is that this representation here, from this, we can efficiently extract information. We know how to efficiently compute expectation values, whereas we didn't know how to do it from here. So tensor network on strip produces a thermal state mirror, which is even, we didn't even know how to do that before this tensor network renormalization. All right, so that was a lot. But the idea is that these tensor network techniques can be applied to statistical mechanical problems, to the computation of partition functions, and also that they connect clearly back to the quantum system in the sense that you end up with when you put one boundary or when you put boundaries to your partition function, you end up with a mirror. And finally, we have just a few minutes. I want to talk about tensor networks in holography. That's another place where tensor networks have been studied quite intensively in the last few years. It's in the context of building toy models for holography or immersion space-time. And this drawing represents a mirror. You can see layers, double layers of tensors, and then just being just, well, it's just a more suggestive way of writing it, drawing it, where you would have a hyperbolic geometry being realized there. So how is mirror related to holography, or is it related to holography? Well, this is still an open question. Okay? But let's see why you would think that it's related to holography. So what's holography? Remember, or hopefully those, well, I don't know. Remember or don't remember, but let me mention what holography is. What we have is a duality between two different theories. On the left-hand side, what we have is a quantum field theory, a conformal field theory. And I'm just going to specialize to the 1 plus 1 case. So what you can think of is, you can think of this cylinder as representing, in this direction, we have space. So I've compactified the space into a circle. Okay, and the vertical direction is time. But you have space and time as being the surface of this cylinder. And in holography, what holography establishes is a duality between a CFT living in 1 plus 1, for instance, in this case, and a theory of gravity, quantum gravity, living on one extra dimension, which corresponds to going inside the cylinder. Okay? So in the theory of gravity, you would still have this vertical direction as being time. But now, not only you have the possibility of going around in one with one time, one space direction, but there is an additional one that corresponds to going inside into the cylinder. Okay? And so in this holographic duality, you have a CFT living in 1 plus 1 dimensions and a theory of gravity living in 2 plus 1 dimensions, which happens to be in hyperbolic space, antidistance. And when we look at mirror, we see some of the same things happening. In which sense? Well, let's forget about time. Time, when we talk about ground states, there is no time dependence. Okay? So the similarities that we would like to see are between a time slice here, so a circle, and the interior of the circle. And if you look at mirror, I'm just going to draw the same tensor network, but look at it, well, just, you know, remember these indices are connected to those ones, and now we just look at the same thing from above, so to say. Right? You can rewrite it, redraw it in this case, and you'll see something like that. And what we find is that at the boundary, we have our quantum system. Right? The open legs here represent the sides of our spin chain. But the tensor network itself is expanding into the interior. Right? So this tensor network takes an extra dimension to represent a wave function at its boundary. So that really sounds like two different objects that are connected, the ground state at the boundary and the tensor network, which extends into the interior. When we look at entanglement entropy, and we computed that as sum of contribution from different scales, actually this is parallel to the calculation that you would do in holography due to Ryu and Takayanagi, looking for minimal surfaces. That's what we were doing here. So that's, sorry, for those who don't know about this, this is how, this is part of this dictionary of the ADS-CFT, how to compute geometric properties in terms of entanglement at the boundary. Okay? But there is some calculation. And I'm saying that calculation that you may or may not know about is very similar to the one we did here when we tried to get an upper bound on the scaling of entanglement entropy in mirror. And again, two-point correlators, we also saw, I told you, how do we understand the two-point correlators, the power law decay of correlations in mirror? Well, it was exponential decay in along geodesics in this hyperbolic geometry. Okay, So there was a geometry there which is hyperbolic, and that's exactly what you have in ADS. Okay? So this type of clear indications led to several people to propose that MERA could be a realization of the ADS-CFT correspondence. And this came in two waves. First, in 2009, Brian Swingle said, OK, let's just do this. Let's look at this tensor network as a time slice of ADS, right? So time slice, because we're talking just about the ground state. Ground state does not depend on time, so we can forget about time. And he said, this is just a time slice of ADS, which happens to be the hyperbolic plane. Hyperbolic plane has this, if you look at the tensor network, it has very similar properties as a discrete version of the hyperbolic plane. It looks like a discrete version of the hyperbolic. But more recently, a number of other researchers, Chek, Lamprow, McKenlich, and Sally, they said, actually, not so simple. Yes, it is. They proposed that Mera, indeed, we should think about it as a realization of holography, but not of a time slice of ADS, but some slightly more complicated structure, which is the integral transform of this time slice, where you look at geodesics here, and well, you map it's the space of geodesics of H2. So it's, you know, it's next level of complexity. I don't think there is any point in going into details now. But the idea is, it's the proposal is still, yes, Mera is realizing holography, but in a slightly different way than the original proposal. And then this is still an open question, whether Mera can be or should be thought of as a realization of holography. It clearly has a number of correct ingredients there. But let me mention why the second proposal. So if we just look at the tensor network as a connection, as a collection of tensors connected in this given way, then it really looks like hyperbolic plane, in the sense that if you look at the shortest path along the network that would connect two distant points, well, that would be the length. If at the boundary the length would be L, in the bulk the length would be log L, and that's exactly what hyperbolic plane can do for you. Okay. On the other hand, the Mera is not just a collection of tensors connected together. Remember that these tensors obey certain constraints. They are unitary, disentanglers, isometries. They are not just random tensors. And remember that we have this picture where Mera was an evolution in real time. It was a quantum computation, right, that was preparing the ground state. So there is a time direction attached to this tensor network. If you just draw this, there is no time direction. Okay? But if you make this explicit, then there is this happens only when you connect the lower indices with the upper ones and so on. There is a special, there is more information, okay, to this tensor network than just the drawing. You have to provide this. And providing this is the same as providing a Lorentzian signature. There is, so if you can think of this as a discretized version of some geometry, then these constraints are telling you there is a time direction. Okay? This geometry comes with a metric which has Lorentzian signature. And so if you put the two ingredients together, instead of being looking like the hyperbolic plane, this looks like the sitter space. Okay? The difference between hyperbolic plane and the sitter is just this change in the signature of the metric. In the hyperbolic plane, there are no preferred directions. You have a Euclidean signature. In the sitter space, which is still hyperbolic, but there is a time direction. Okay? So it's Lorentzian signature. And so when you take into account Mera's causal structure, which gives it a Lorentzian signature, that seems to indicate that maybe it's a discretization. Or if it's a discretization of something in holography, that would be this kinematic space, which happens to be also this ether. Okay? Very good. That was rushed, but it's time to conclude. So I'm going to just summarize the course in 1 minute. So this was about many-body entanglement and tensor networks. Over the last 3 weeks, what we've seen, we started with part one. We talked about the many-body computational challenge. We saw that generically simulating quantum systems came with a cost that grew exponentially in the system size. And we learned a number of things. We learned Julia, or you played around with Julia. We discussed exact normalization and Langtus techniques to get ground states. You know, it's exponentially hard, but you still can do it for a small system. We talked about you've learned about the free Fermi formalism that allows you to go to much larger systems, but only for free particle systems, so that's, you know, not generically. And then the second part of the course, the second week roughly, we talk about ground state entanglement. we saw that there is this area law, okay? And we learned how to compute entanglement entropies using the techniques we had learned. And then in the third week, we learned how to, inspired by this area law, we've learned about this tensor network, which these tensor networks, which are just a way of representing ground states, and then efficiently, right? So instead of a cost exponential in n, we learned that we could do things just by based on the fact that these ground states are very special and obey the area law. We learned how to efficiently simulate those with order n cost. And tensor networks are not just the basis for a computational approach, but they also tell us about the structure of ground states. I told you that once MERA succeeds at representing ground states, we learn that we could think of ground states as a result of this entangling process in scale. So that's, you know, that's a physical picture that we didn't have before. We've learned tensor networks can also be used for SRC transformation. And today we briefly mentioned connection to statistical mechanics and holography. That's it. And yeah, I can take questions. I'm just worried that it's a bit late. But if you have questions, maybe we can chat. Maybe, yeah, after the class or